Good evening and welcome to my Stogie Mystagogy with your hosts, Don Gonzalez and
Mark Connolly.
And with our perpetual guest,
Kevin Gonzalez.
This is episode 24 of season 2. So, two segments tonight. First segment, what are you smoking now? I think Mark and I are both smoking something different. I think Kevin is smoking something different as well. So we will review all three cigars. We will not review our drink because we are drinking Elijah Craig once again. Got some feedback from a listener that we should not do a review or talk about something that we've already done before, so we're not going to talk about it.
Okay.
So that's us listening to our listeners. And our second segment is going to be a discussion about rights and responsibilities, or properly stated, if we look at the canon law, duties and rights.
Right.
Yes, I said duties.
Duties.
All right. Mark, what are you smoking now?
I am smoking a Rocky Patel Vintage 1992. And this is the Robusto size. It's 5.5 inches and a 50 ring gauge. And this was rated 91 by Cigar Insider, I think. Yeah, I've seen ratings as low as 87. And so I've seen 87s, 88s, 89s, and 90s. But I'll go with the 91 because it sounds cooler. This is a Nicaraguan and Dominican filler with a 10-year-old Ecuadorian Sumatran wrapper. The fillers have Ligero in it as well, so it gives it some spiciness. And this cigar is well built. It's a nice draw. It's burning very evenly. No problem holding an ash at least an inch long. And so far, so good. It had a wrapper that is a dark chocolate. And I want to say it's a Maduro just because it's dark, but I saw one write-up that said it was dark natural, which is not something I've run into before, so I'm not sure what that means. So I'm just going to say it's a Maduro because it's dark. The wrapper has kind of a sheeny look to it, but it doesn't feel oily or anything like that. It's an attractive cigar. You can see the lines where it wraps. Some people might think that detracts, but I don't think it does. The starting draw was very smooth, and I'm about a third of the way in, and it's just smoking really, really easy. No danger of it going out so far. And there is a spiciness to it. That's from the Ligero. And I'm going to say a little bit of a coffee note that I'm detecting here. Colombian coffee. Okay, that's a stretch. Anyway, it's a good cigar. The price point is about $7 or $7.50, depending on where you're going. Unless you're going to a certain unnamed cigar place, then it'd probably be $10.50. So, but I'm enjoying it.
Which year did you say that was?
Vintage 1992.
Okay. So it looks like they may have packaged that a little bit differently than they used to.
Yeah, apparently there's vintage 1990 as well.
Yes.
It's got a different wrapper.
Yes.
Same filler and binder, different wrapper.
It used to have a burgundy band to it. Some of the older models I had.
Yeah.
So this one is,
this was black and gold.
Okay. Used to be burgundy and gold, but sounds like it's the same cigar.
Yeah.
I've smoked that before and picked up hints of pepper from that as well. Good with steak. Not while you're eating the steak, smoking the cigar, but having the steak beforehand.
Yeah.
You know, that idea again that not only the beverage that you drink while you're smoking the cigar, but sometimes also the food that you have before you smoke a cigar can help activate your palate in such a way that it helps pull out some of the other flavors.
So I had Thai curry chicken prior to this event. I like curry. I don't know if that's impacting this or not. This is a, they call it a light box press, so it is a box pressed cigar.
You can see the slight.
But it's not, it doesn't have like a corners on it.
Yeah, it's not as pronounced as the one you smoked last week. All right. So. Good draw?
Oh, yeah.
All right, Kevin, what are you smoking?
I've got an Arturo Fuente Gran Reserva. It's a 4 Phoenix 858. It is 6 inch long. I want to say it's a. Is the second? Is that the ring gauge? The 47. Yeah. It's a 47 ring gauge. They're usually rolled in either African Cameroon, Connecticut, or Ecuadorian sunshade wrapper. I'm not skilled enough to know.
That's probably the sunshade wrapper.
That's the way it looks. Yeah, that's what I was leaning towards, but I didn't know if I wasn't going to, like, come on.
Because the Cameroon is going to be, it's still a little bit on the dark side, but it's going to be more brown. That is darker, almost an espresso color. Like espresso bean, that's what I mean.
I do know that they age them in Spanish cedar vaults, and that's one of the first things that you can, when you pull it out of the wrapper, it's one of the first things that you pick up on the aroma. And it's, I love any cigars that just smell fabulous before you've ever done anything with them. And this one smells fantastic. And now that I've been, I'm probably 3/4 of the way through with it already. And it's been fantastic the whole time.
I think you're halfway through.
Halfway through it. Yeah, that's why I'm not good at math. That's why I do history. But it's supposed to have, obviously, a cedar, which you can definitely taste. You actually have a pretty good cedar flavor. It also has supposed to have, if I could talk, a hint of honey, which I can kind of smell on the aroma side, but you don't get much of it on while you're smoking it. But regardless, it is a mighty fine cigar indeed.
Very nice.
I'm smoking a Rocky Patel Decade Cameroon, and this is, at first when I bought it, I wasn't wearing my reading glasses when I bought it, I thought it was a Robusto size, it's not. The ring gauge is definitely 47, and actually the length looks like it's about 50, so I don't remember what they call that size. A Lonsdale, maybe? I don't know.
Not sure.
This is made, obviously, it is a Cameroon wrapper. You've heard me before. I'm a big fan of the Cameroon wrapper on the Hemingway series of Arturo Fuente. The filler and binder are both Nicaraguan, but the cigar is made in Honduras. I thought was interesting. It is a medium to bold, or medium to full cigar. I think it's more on the medium side. It is classified as a full-bodied cigar in terms of its flavors. I don't think I buy that either, because it's pretty simple in its flavor profile. It's peppery, and the hint of sweetness that comes off the Cameroon, and that's pretty much it. This is a highly regarded cigar. It's been around for a while, and the interesting thing about this cigar is that it came out about 7 years ago, I think. And when it came out, it first came out as a Connecticut wrapper. And that one's very creamy. And then they came out with an Ecuadorian, whatever, what did you say yours was?
This was an Ecuadorian Sumatran.
Okay, so they've made this cigar the Decade with that same wrapper on it.
Oh, yeah.
And the Cameroon is the third different wrapper. So what they did is they took the same binder and filler and just put a different wrapper around it to give it a different flavor profile.
Okay.
And so that's what they've done with this. And like I said, so hints of pepper, maybe a little bit of creaminess, certainly that regular tobacco taste, and I can pick up a little hint of sweetness that hopefully will be on the back end as well. The normal price point on this is $9. I stopped at a cigar shop that's known for jacking up their prices, and I paid $12 for the cigar.
Wow.
But this is more of a $9 cigar.
All right.
So that's what we're smoking now.
All right. And as usual, we'll revisit at the end for final thoughts on the cigars. Don mentioned we're drinking it with the Elijah Craig. So we talked about that last week. but it's, I think it goes well with this cigar.
I'm rolling in mango lemonade.
Yeah. Tell us about your mango lemonade.
It's commercially made. It's got a hint of crushed ice and a flavor of styrofoam cup.
All right.
You gotta be the only person on the planet that drinks lemonade with their cigars. I can see maybe drinking lemonade with a Connecticut cigar.
Yeah.
But, hey, to each his own. That's the spirit of the show. Drink what you want to drink. If you like it, great.
Yeah.
If you like the cigar, awesome. All right, so our topic for the big segment is rights and responsibilities. So we like to start off with definitions.
Right.
Do we have a definition for right?
Well, I was going to start kind of earlier because all of this seems to tie into legality.
At you least. Mean by that, like, the law?
The law.
The rule of law, that yes. sort of thing?
Yeah. Because usually when someone says something about their rights, they support it at some level with a reference to some law. And so, and a lot of quote-unquote rights get made into law, as we've seen in the last few years with different rulings by the Supreme Court on different areas. So I want to start with a Thomistic definition, and this comes from the Summa, and it's in Parts 1 and 2a, Question 90, Article 4. And St. Thomas says, the definition of law is an ordinance of reason for the common good made by him who has care for the community and promulgated. So there's a couple of pieces there. One of them is an ordinance of reason. So that means that there's some sort of rationality behind the law. The reason depends on whether or not it's for the common good for it to be rightly considered a law. And as we've discussed in the past, the common good is not the greatest good for the greatest number, but it's those goods that cannot be exhausted by sharing them. Made by him who has care for the community. So there's an authority aspect to this. And then promulgated means that it's published. It doesn't go into effect until it's been made into a law and communicated in some manner. And so from that, we can go to American civil law, which is essentially created for the ordering of society. And I want to contrast that with canon law, which is made for the ordering of society so that holiness and salvation can be achieved. So there's a kind of a bigger concept behind the concept of an ordered society. So within that, most people think of rights, and I think we've maybe even said this before, but I've heard it said many times that somebody will say, well, your rights end where my rights begin.
Right.
I've always a little bit disagreed with that. I think that's fine when you're talking about between individuals, but when you're talking about societally, if we have certain rights, as the Constitution said, or the Declaration of Independence enumerated just three, it said among these, and it referenced unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
What does that mean, unalienable?
Means that they cannot be taken away. And that's actually rooted in natural law, which I'll talk about in a second. Let's say I'm a policeman and you're a criminal. What gives me the right to take away your liberty? So there's an aspect to this because in law, we frequently will take away one of these unalienable rights. Capital punishment, put people to death. Liberty, we put people in jail.
Well, from a legalistic standpoint, the protection is due process.
Right.
There has to be a measure of due process, which really is a fancy way of saying that the state has to follow its own rules of justice and equity in enforcing whatever the laws are.
Right.
In order to be able to do that.
So, what that made me think about is, so what is really the basis of these rights? Why do we have rights? What are they for? You know, American civil laws, as I mentioned, is for the ordering of society, but to what end? I mentioned canon law says the ordering of society toward the end of holiness and salvation being achieved. The rights that we talk about from the Declaration of Independence, it says in the Declaration of Independence that those rights came from God. And if you can't take away a right from God, then what's this all about? So I think you start to run into a problem if you start with rights. So in canon law, you actually start with duties. So most Americans think, I have rights, therefore you have a duty not to infringe on my rights. The canon law perspective is, I have rights because I have duties or obligations. There are things that I am supposed to do. In order to do those, I have to have the means to do that. I have the right to go to church. I have the right to educate my children. I have the right to get an education. I have the right to have a job. Those kinds of things. If I have a duty to take care of my family, I have the right to earn a living to take care of my family. It's a little bit different perspective than I think just beginning with rights.
Doesn't that presume that rights are contained within the context of the common good?
Yes.
And not the individual.
Yes. So it's not your rights end where my rights begin. It's I have duties. And in order to fulfill those duties, I have rights.
And are those duties to the individual or to the society?
They're to the society. Good? They're to the common good.
Okay. And that's what's missing.
Yes, that's what I think.
No, I agree with you. Because, you know, as I said before the show, the world we live in is a world that's ruled by radical individualism. And rights are all about the individual in a vacuum, almost, you know, absent any regard for society, the common good, or anyone else.
Right.
And as we've talked a little bit about before we went on air, that's part of the challenge, is that there's... When you do that, you default to this world where you have competing claims of rights without any means to objectively judge
right.
which right trumps the other right, and consequently, that's why you can't have real discussion.
True. You know, in the Declaration of Independence, it says that governments are instituted to secure these rights. So while it starts by saying that these are unalienable rights, and they're from God, it then goes to the governments being responsible for safeguarding those rights. But then the government derives its powers. Now, this again is the Declaration, which was written for a purpose, okay? But the government derives its powers from the consent of the governed. And giving the people the right to alter or abolish the government, which was the whole basis for the Declaration of Independence from the king. Sadly, though, by the time you get to there, God's kind of left the building. Because now it's about governments and it's about people. And then if the people don't like the government, then they swap it out.
Right.
And so then you get into a situation where the people become the measure of what our rights are. And you've kind of lost your foundation for the basis of a right. Which is why I wanted to go back to that canon law definition, which is, I have duties, therefore I have rights. So.
What's the implication of that?
Well, I guess the negative implication of not having that is you get into everybody just talking about my rights.
So what's the positive implication of that?
The positive implication of that is there's a corrective to that. That overall understanding of duties implies some kind of authority outside of government, outside of people. Basically, God is what I'm getting at. The concept that was used in the Declaration of Independence referred to these natural laws, basically, that are God-made as being the basis of why people can reject a government. The problem with that is when you go there, then you basically start to leave God out. Because if you can revolt against an authority figure, then you can revolt against God as just an authority figure. And I think that's what's, I think that's a undercurrent today. The refusal to recognize a moral authority that is without question. Hence, don't bring your religion into my politics.
Right.
The whole foundation of the politics depends on this idea that we have these rights that were given to us by some authority, be it God or be it a government.
Right, and that's an important distinction. As we talked a little bit before we went on air, that the government is the one that is giving you the rights, then they can certainly take them away.
Yeah. And our only option, if we don't like the government that's taking them away, is revolution. And I think that drives a lot of some of the madness that we see specifically in South America. Large pieces of South America. It almost seems like some piece of South America has been in a state of revolution my entire life, and probably before me.
So, you know, it seems to me that when they constructed this idea, that the notion was that the government was defined as a government when it was legitimate.
Right.
And it's legitimate when it protects the rights of the people.
Right.
Whatever those are. So, you know, I think somebody who might be a strict constitutional constructionist would say only those rights that are enumerated in the Constitution, in our country.
Right.
So where do the other rights come from? And who acknowledges these?
Right.
So, I mean, that's, in our country at least, I think that's part of the problem, is that we've gone from this borderline thought that, you know, the early political philosophers like Rousseau and Locke, who had this notion of natural rights, and like you said, have very quickly kind of abandoned the notion that those rights came or stem from God.
Right.
To this place now where we are now, we're almost like we act like those rights stem from the government. The government has replaced God. Is that a fair statement?
Yes. Yeah, I think in most people's minds, they see government as a guarantor of their rights. And as you mentioned, the problem with that is if you have a corrupt government, then your rights are subject to change. And at no point in any of this is the discussion of what is society's obligation to its individuals, and what is the individual's obligation to society. So when you don't have, when you're going to simply say, you know, it's an a priori argument that was used in the Declaration. These are self-evident truths. So once you set aside the self-evident part of it, and you're just talking about my rights, and you're not thinking about where you got those rights from, you lose your ability, to argue convincingly that you should have any particular right. It's just, what do the people want?
I mean, but is it even that? I mean, are we in a place now where it's like, what do the courts say?
True. Which is an interesting, just as a side note, in civil law, the decision...
Can I stop you for a second? Because you keep saying civil law, and I don't think you mean civil law the way I think of civil law.
Okay.
Having been trained in law school, civil law is distinguished from criminal law to be law that is generally between two individuals or two corporations suing over money, like a contract or something like that. I think that when you're talking about civil law, you mean as opposed to canon law.
Yes.
Okay, so I think that's an important distinction.
Okay.
If you're talking So that, in that context, you, when you say civil law, you're actually talking about both our criminal system and our civil system of people suing each other and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
it,
I guess
it includes both.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, I guess, a distinction that needs to be brought out.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing happened when we were taking our canon law class and our moral and ethics classes, that distinction got made.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about civil law and...
Our law, and I'm going to say civil and criminal, there are legislatures who create the law, but the courts interpret, enforce, and determine the meaning. In canon law, the legislators who wrote the law are also the people who interpret it.
It's an important distinction.
Yes. And so what's happened is you can have, in our country, legislatures write a law, and it can be interpreted to be something that was never intended by the people who wrote the law. For an example, the so-called right to privacy, which was never written into law. It's been interpreted into law. Under canon law, something like that wouldn't happen because the people who wrote the law get to say, no, what I meant was this. And in our current jurisprudence, if that's the right word, the legislatures can write the law, but the legislators, I mean the courts, can go, yeah, but what that really means is this. And it doesn't matter if the legislatures say, that's not what I intended. And I think that's a problem.
Well, it's most definitely a problem if you just look at it from the way the government operates. Because when this Democratic Republic was founded, the notion was that that there would be a check on each of the branches of government.
Right.
That the court system would act merely as a check on the legislative body and the executive body to a certain extent as well in creating laws that were just. And when they're not, the court essentially steps in and says, no.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but there's not a check on the court.
There is kind of a check on the court. I don't want this to turn into a government class or a civics class, but it's a very weak one. And the weak one is impeach the justices. Other than that, I think we actually live in a time in which the courts have taken on a significant amount of power.
Yeah.
And the reason I pointed out the 1954 case of Brown versus Board, and don't get me wrong, I think that's, to me, that's a very important case, and we could debate on whether or not the basis on which it was determined is right or wrong. You know, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, a responsibility to say evil is evil. And I think that that's part of what the court did at that time. I think what's interesting, though, is that there was this kind of tension that existed from 1954 until the 70s between the court and the legislative bodies. Because even though Brown was put into effect in 1954, most of what Brown talked about didn't really go into effect until the 1970s. And it was done through legislation.
Yeah.
Because the court doesn't have an enforcement branch.
Right.
They don't have an army, they don't have a police force. It's all kind of based on the civility of humanity of the citizens to follow what the court says. I remember being taught as in middle school, the court is the supreme law of the land. And fast forward to where we are now, you know, we're also taught, let me back up a little bit, we're also taught that very simplistically, that the legislative body made the law, the judicial body interpreted the law, and the executive enforced the law. We all heard that in middle school, right?
Right.
But that's not what really happens. You've got the executive branch issuing executive orders that have the effect of law.
Right.
And that has increased exponentially over the years. And there seems to be at times no check on that, except for maybe the court. the court. Regardless of what your political spin is, I would argue that both conservative and liberal courts have done this, where they become activists and create laws, not laws, but rights, where rights did not previously exist, nor would you be able to find them in the Constitution.
Right. And to me, that raises the question of, what are these rights for, and what are we supposed to do with them? And the reason I brought up canon law, not to just go on repeating myself, but I think people are would be hard pressed to say, why do we, you know, what is the value of our rights? What are they for? And I think it's primarily so that individuals don't get trampled by whatever, other individuals or government or whatever. But that's not a very productive view of rights, I think. It's purely a defense, but canon law would suggest that the function of rights is to permit you to fulfill your obligations. And so what's missing from all of this rights talk is, what is your responsibility? What responsibilities do you have with those rights? Or do you have any?
Well, that's something that's absent in the modern discourse. Nobody talks about responsibility.
Right.
I think that maybe before World War II, people used to talk that way. I mean, heck, I don't know the extent, I mean, because I teach at work at a special school. How many schools have civics classes anymore?
Yeah, I don't know. None.
So, those used to be a method by which schools could teach kids essentially what their responsibility is as citizens.
Yeah. And what does it even mean to be a responsible citizen these days?
I really don't know the answer to that question. I would say in the old days it meant voting, being politically involved. In the spirit of Thomas Jefferson, I think it also means that if the government in which you are governed becomes illegitimate, you overthrow it.
Yeah.
Jefferson was pretty much a radical when it came to that. Jefferson did not think we were going to turn out the way we did. He, I think, legitimately felt that there would be continuous overturnings of the status quo of the government. The government would not be this ongoing thing.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how efficient that type of system of government is.
Well, I think it was, and I don't want to spend too much time on just the government part of it, because we still need to talk about what do we do with these rights. But I think part of the point was to have an inefficient government.
To keep it weak?
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why everybody's moving from California to Texas is because Texas has a weak government by design. So I think the idea is if the government's too efficient, I mean, it'll turn into fascism. You know, and I think people worry in this country about socialism, but I really think the real danger is fascism. I think if you look at the way things are going, and if you look up the definitions, we're more like moving toward a fascist form of government than we are socialist, I think. That's maybe a topic for another day, but the point is that what are we supposed to do with these rights?
Promote the common good.
Yeah.
I think that's the short answer.
Yeah.
And you can only promote the common good if your rights are rooted in that notion. And it seems to me that we go back to a conversation we had a couple weeks ago with this notion of solidarity, subsidiarity, the dignity of man.
Right.
And all of that.
Yeah, I think it's all related.
And then in a world where you don't have those discussions, you wind up in the muck that we're in.
Yeah.
Because I don't mean to beat this into the ground, but people don't talk about the common good.
No.
And the reality of it is, if we as a society were living out our duties as we were meant to, it would lessen the need for government.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got Hurricane Harvey, like, buried Houston underwater. And I saw some people on TV, it's a grassroots action. People are gathering stuff.
Yeah, well, the Cajun Navy, for example.
Yeah.
There's a group of people who take their boats to... That wasn't activated by the government.
No.
I saw another meme on some social media. It was either Instagram or Facebook, where there's a picture of all these FEMA-type trucks that can't get to Houston, yet HEB, a private company, is able to feed people.
Right. So what this guy on TV was saying was that, you know, we have to do this because government can't.
I mean, how many times do we have to see that FEMA fails at this?
Yeah. So what I'm getting at is, I think to our credit, this disaster in Houston brings out the best in people, and it awakens that sense of, man, somebody's got to do something, and I guess I'm going to do it.
It's when you really see neighbors be neighbors, too.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm really trying to say is it shouldn't take a disaster for us to have that sense of responsibility toward our fellow man. But when there's not a disaster, our default position is, well, the government's supposed to do that.
Right.
And I think that is the point of duties and rights that flow from those duties.
So I don't know if this is related, and if I'm just way off course, just tell me. But we at our school hired a new math teacher this year. And she had been teaching in a Mexican private school for many years. And she just moved to the United States recently. And day one, she actually started teaching content. So that's different. You know, most of our teachers spend a day or two talking about their policies and the syllabus and this idea. She started teaching content from day one. And the second thing she did is she started teaching with this idea. This is algebra 2, I think. You don't need a calculator.
Right.
And I was getting feedback from students saying, why isn't she giving us calculators? Because there's this assumption that the school, i.e. the state, is going to provide you with calculators.
Right.
Forget about the fact that they're incapable of solving these problems without a calculator. They think the state needs to provide them with that calculator.
Right.
That's kind of messed up.
Yeah.
And that's that dependence.
Right.
And call me a cynic, but I think that the government has enabled that attitude.
Well, yeah. And the result is people no longer feel that they need to be able to take care of themselves. There's no sense being taught from parent to child that you need to be able to take care of yourself.
And that violates the notion of solidarity.
Yeah.
And violates the dignity of the human being.
It does. It does. And so, again, there's the focus on, well, I have a right to a calculator. Why do you have a right to a calculator? What is the basis of that right? That's not life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's, I'm supposed to have a calculator. That's not a right. Not really.
No.
Calculators don't promote the common good in a classroom, in algebra 2. So why should the state provide calculators? Especially when you don't need one. It's not even a need.
So where do we go from there?
Well, I do think this goes back to that concept of Catholic social doctrine and the common good. And from a Catholic perspective, the common good is to permit a situation where people can become holy,
okay,
and get to heaven. That has nothing to do with a calculator. Right? But you can't even talk about that. You know, if we were to say in a public forum that we have rights so that people can get to heaven, we would be laughed at.
What if we framed it this way, though? That we have rights so that people can be more fully human. Because isn't that the essence of pursuing holiness?
Yeah. The glory of God is a man fully alive.
And I don't know how we recapture that.
Well, as individuals, the first thing we have to do is teach our children what their responsibilities are to themselves, to the society, to the family. So to themselves, to the family, to their city, to their state, to their government. You know, I understand the sentiment that Kennedy was using when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. There's a big truth in there. What he was talking about was our responsibility as citizens to promote the common good. At least that's what I think.
I think that there's some of that burns in the hearts of people. And the reason I say that is because, I've just been kind of following. I've got a lot of family down in Houston. I've even got some former students of mine that are going to school in Houston. I actually saw a photo of a couple of my former students who go to school at the University of Houston. And their fraternity brothers have gathered together to go help at the shelter. Now, they may not know that they're activated by a need to serve the common good, but that's what they're doing.
Yes.
And I think that one of the things that we can do, as you say, as parents and just leaders in general, is to help promote that. Recognize it. Call it what it is. Because you're right. It's only during times of crisis that we even have any attention brought to that sort of thing.
Yeah. It's interesting that it comes out so naturally. That tells me that it's in there in us. It's part of our fabric. But it should be also that nascent understanding should be developed by parents and by teachers so that we can have a more successful society. You know, I think when people go, well, that's my rights, I think one of the things you do is you go, what are you going to do with that right? How are you going to use that right to make things better for all of us? So I mentioned at the beginning that I was referencing the Declaration of Independence and its basing rights essentially on natural law, but we haven't really defined natural law. So Kevin, our catechism master, has some words of wisdom for us.
In paragraphs 1954 through 1960, he talks about the natural moral law. And I'm just going to grab tidbits from it. He talks about the natural law expresses the original moral sense which enables man to discern by reason the good and the evil, the truth and the lie. The law is called natural not in reference to the nature of irrational beings, but because reason, which decrees it properly, belongs to human nature. St. Augustine asked the question, where then are these rules written, if not in the book of that light we call the truth? In it is written every just law. From it the law passes into the heart of the man who does justice.
So if I would interrupt, I would just say I think that's the basis of why we see the response that we see in these cases of national disasters. Because nobody said, you have to go collect water, you have to go get toilet paper. People just spontaneously did that because it's written in their hearts.
Well, certainly, 1956 addresses us as the natural law present in the heart of each man and established by reason is universal in its precepts and its authority extends to all men. St. Thomas Aquinas said the natural law is nothing other than the light of understanding placed in us by God. Through it, we know what we must do and what we must avoid. And then, a little deeper, when we look into the encyclical Pope John, the 23rd, Pacem in Terris, he talks about, we're talking about rights and duties. He's talking about, for somebody to claim their right, but to ignore the duties is is on par with building a house with one hand and tearing it down with the other. And in here, without actually, you know, quoting it, he talks a lot about, there's a list of rights that are common, even today that we see, that we'll probably see throughout eternity, rights pertaining to moral and cultural values, worshiping God according to one's conscience, to choose freely one's state in life, all those, any type of right that we're referencing, there's going to be a duty that goes with it, not just for ourselves, but that must be extended to our neighbor. There's a reciprocity?
Reciprocity.
Yeah, thank you. Involved.
Yeah, and I think that's missing. You know, you brought up the Bill of Rights. In canon law, there's essentially a Bill of Duties and Rights.
Okay.
And it's canons 208 through 231, but they basically call out what the responsibilities, obligations, duties of the faithful are. And especially for the lay faithful, and I think we've mentioned this before, but it is our job to perfect the temporal order. That's one of our duties. And as we've said multiple times now, in order to do that, you have to have the ability to do that. You have the right to take the actions, to do the things that you need to do to perfect the temporal order. And that means essentially raising your kids and then having conversations with people to help them understand that the rights they have come with obligations.
Right. And that's what's missing right now.
Yeah.
You know, I said off air that one of the texts that I read in preparation for tonight is a book called Rights Talk by Marianne Glendon.
Yeah.
Who's a Harvard professor and also the former ambassador to the Vatican. And one of the things that she points out in her book is that missing in our founding documents, and when she talked about the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, is any mention of duties talk.
Yeah.
And so when we spend, as a society, talking about nothing but rights, absent that responsibility that comes from it, you have a society of people who are only focused on the right part, which lends itself to the individual and not the community or society.
Yeah.
Interestingly, she points out that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was produced by the United Nations actually does point out that everyone has duties to the community. So that's an interesting contrast that we don't have here in our country. So, I mean, at the root of it, you know, we've talked before in other episodes about how it's so difficult to have good conversations with people who disagree with you.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of this. It's because there is no thought of the common good. It's, here's my individual right, and you're talking about it. And both sides of, you know, to use political terms, the left and the right, and that's what people talk about most of the time. I think that both sides, both camps, are locked into this rights talk. And no one's talking about the common good. And so when, and the common good is the common ground where there can be real discourse or a real exchange of ideas to figure out how can we work through these things. We're stuck in kind of a loop.
Yeah, we are. We are. Because at some level, I think the simplistic understanding of rights today is basically, I have the right to do whatever I want to do. The end. And if you were going to try to push people to say, okay, well, then do you have the right to yell fire in a crowded theater and all that? Well, they go, well, no, of course not. But you have to raise that question to even get there, because the basic understanding is I should be able to do whatever I want to do.
But when you bring that up, why can't you say fire in a theater? Because of the effect that it has for the community that's in that theater.
Right.
That's the common good.
Yeah.
But we don't recognize that.
Right.
There's not a harmonization of interest. I think to truly have the common good in mind, you have to be able to look at what your self-interests are and pair them with the interests of your community and find that common ground. And this may be a little stretched, but you know, when we talk about like equality, for instance, because I think I would argue that equality comes into play here. True equality is not what a lot of groups are after now. It's, we felt, you have one group looking at another group saying, we felt discrimination from you, or we felt pressured by your opinions or your thoughts or your beliefs, one way or the other. And instead of saying, we want to be on par, we want to have equal rights and equal duties, it's, let's turn the table completely and just flip the roles versus finding that commonality. And I think, you know, we talked about looking, you know, talking about things like Harvey and other disasters that take place that tend to bring people together. And I think that's when things are going well, we go back into just self-interest, self-preservation mode. And you see it, and not just in big things, just in little things. Like, okay, this is a base example, but I think it works. Driving in traffic, you have stop and go traffic. You have individuals, for instance, 635 and 75 is a prime example of this. I see it every morning. There are two lanes that get off of 635 on a highway 75. I would say the people looking out for the common good of everybody getting to work on time are the ones that get in line and are patient. But then you have those that are not looking out for the common good and have their own self-interest in mind and wait till the very last second to move over and are putting multiple lives at risk. And I can validate by the amount and the severity of the accidents I've seen.
Sure.
Where if everybody was looking out for everybody else and actually got in line like they're supposed to...
The zipper...
Yeah,
the line
was so smooth. And I talked about zipper in. You know, everybody takes a turn and goes in.
Right.
And the line
that's
moves.
People being civil.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, again, that's on a base level, but I think you can take that same concept, that same thought, and extend it to larger matters.
You know, I think a fair question to ask anybody who's claiming a right is to say, okay, so what duty or obligation to the common good are you going to achieve through exercising your right?
Say that again.
What duty or obligation to the common good are you going to achieve or effect through the exercise of the right you are claiming? Mm. I think that's a question that could be asked a lot. And for a lot of the rights that are being requested out there or expected or assumed, there's not an answer to that question. That they would have be hard pressed to answer that question.
Well, maybe that's part of the solution, is to force those conversations.
Yeah, I think so. So I think we need to start asking that question. And so he says, well, I have a right to blah, blah, blah. So, okay, how are you going to make our world a better place by exercising that right?
That is a thought-filled question. Because I'm just rolling through thoughts in my own head of just rights. Just... On a government level, just basic things that, at least in Texas, that we have that we take for granted. Just like, how am I, you know, utilizing, how am I answering that question?
Yeah. I think it's a good question.
I think it's one that needs to be asked, not just to each other, but definitely of our leaders. You know, when they bring forth these ideas and their agendas and et cetera, asking those questions. You know, I think that would be... That's hardcore. That's deep. Because on a basic level, you have a city ordinance that comes down. Go to the city council meeting. Get up there and actually ask that question of the people that are in charge of governing your city.
Yeah.
You know, what does this do for the betterment of our city?
And you bring up a good point, because Catholic social doctrine says you have a responsibility to be an engaged citizen.
Yeah.
You can't just sit back in your prayer closet and say, well, I'll just pray about it. I'm not trying to minimize the effect of prayer, but there is a call to action as well.
Well, and just voting doesn't accomplish that. And the reason I say that is because if you're not involved in the process to figure out what's being voted on, then you're not involved. And that's I'm saying that to myself. You know, if I'm not involved in even what are the topics that are being voted on, then just voting on somebody else's slate that you had no involvement in is not being an involved citizen.
Right.
I was going to say that, you know, my wife and I, we've had those conversations, because there are particular subjects, and I can't think of one right off the top of my head, but I remember that there's conversations we've had where she gets heated about something she'll see on the news or on an article or something like that, and she's got fire and brimstone thoughts and feelings, just, you know, or just passionate thoughts, whatever the case may be, and it's like, that's great. But I've asked her, and I wasn't thinking about, you know, the scope for which we're talking about now, but I think it falls in line with, what are you going to do about it? Like, I'm not saying you're wrong, I'm not saying you're right, mm-hmm. but coming at me is not going to do anything. And I think that's, I've naturally been having those thoughts lately, and I think it stemmed from social media, because if there's one thing I avoid more than anything, it's comment section of any website.
Online debates.
Well, I don't even like calling online debates, because I have such a respect for the word debate. It's people blasting off horrendous. It's just an insult fest. It's, oh, I disagree with you, but instead of having a legitimate conversation with you about that disagreement and trying to find common ground, regardless of what the topic is, it's, well, you're an idiot.
Right.
Because I'm right, and you clearly don't have a clue what you're talking about. And just throwing out, it's just, there's that lack of personal one-on-one communication and involvement with one another. And I remember early on there was talk, and I don't think, it never went anywhere, but about, and we talk about working with our children and teaching our children. I think now, especially being a parent of a toddler, one of the things that I have to do as a parent is ensure that my daughter growing up realizes, if you wouldn't say it to their face, don't put it online. That distance, that just because there's a distance and technology as a middleman, doesn't negate the fact that all you're doing is creating harm. Whether it be emotional or, unfortunately, with cyberbullying, physical harm.
Yeah.
What?
So I would argue that since that is detrimental to the common good, you don't have the right to make those comments.
And that's where your rights stop.
Yeah. How should we sum this up?
Well, I have a pretty good quote from Pope Benedict XVI.
All right.
I'm not going to read the whole thing, because it's like four paragraphs long. But I'll pull out the main nuggets. This is from his document, Caritas in Veritate. Love and Truth. Is that right?
I believe so.
And he says, it's important to call for a renewed reflection on how rights presupposes duties if they're not to become mere license, and that's what we've been talking about. And nowadays, we are witnessing a grave inconsistency. And then he goes on to say, duties set a limit on rights because they point to the anthropological and ethical framework of which rights are a part, in this way ensuring that they do not become license. If the only basis of human rights is to be found in the deliberations of an assembly of citizens, those rights can be changed at any time. And that's a real danger. Then they're not unalienable. And then he concludes by saying, when this happens, the authentic development of peoples is endangered. And he concludes by saying, the sharing of reciprocal duties is a more powerful incentive to action than the mere assertion of rights. And that's in Caritas in Veritate, number 43.
Charity and truth.
Charity. Charity and truth. So speak the truth in a charitable way. Bring up rights and responsibilities. I guess we just have to start talking about it.
Yeah.
What responsibilities do we have as citizenry to the common good?
Yeah.
And try to draw away from the focus on the radical individualism in which we live and start focusing on the common good.
Yeah.
And that starts with everyday, ordinary people.
Yep.
Having those discussions. That maybe instead of getting trapped into these debates about a right to this versus a right to that, we start talking about what is the responsibility that we have to the common good and start there and have the discussion based on that.
Yes. All right. I like that.
You know, as I laugh because I feel like, you know, the last couple of talks we throw out a lot of ideas and hopefully they're thought-provoking. I think that's the best we can do right now is provoke some thought. Hopefully provoking thought leads to provoking action. We're not going to solve the problems of the world here smoking cigars and
right.
Drinking, having a drink. But at least maybe we can get some people to start thinking about it. If we just affect a couple of people who listen to the podcast right. And start having these conversations, that's where it starts.
Yeah.
And whoever's listening to, you know, when you listen to this episode, dedicate yourself to that idea of talking about rights in the context of the responsibility to the common good, and maybe we can start the wheels in motion to affect change in society, to get things back on track.
Yep.
If I can tag on that, you know, start small. One of the things that one of my peers at work has talked about, I don't remember where I read it, but it's this idea of if you do, like, making your bed in the morning. If you get up and make your bed in the morning, you've now accomplished something. That accomplishment leads to the desire of accomplishing something else. And then when you complete your next task, you get excited about completing the next task after that. I think that's why when I start cleaning, I tell my wife, leave me alone, let me roll, because if you break... If you cause me to make me take a time out, I'm going to end up stopping what I'm doing. But if you've got kids, start at school. Be involved in school. Or if you don't have kids, be involved at work on some level if you're able to. Or at church. Or pick something. But yeah. Just at least pray about it and seriously think about it.
Well, you're onto something there. Be involved in your schools. Be an agent. You use... the phrase that's out there, be an agent of change for the common good in your local area. That can be the schools. Be on the PTA. Be on what they call site-based management committees. And be the voice of the common good in your community.
Yeah.
And for some people, that might mean God's calling you to run for office.
Yeah. Could be.
Could be. Any final thoughts on the cigars y'all smoked?
Well, I smoked mine down to where I was burning my fingers, so...
That's a good cigar.
That's a good cigar. Sometimes cigars will change their profiles as you're smoking them through. This one pretty much stayed the same all the way through. It was very consistent. There was a creaminess to it. I will say that in the last third, which is why I kept smoking it. I enjoyed that. So, good cigar.
Kevin?
I think I found a new favorite.
Really?
Yeah, you smoke way more of that than
I've ever seen. Than normally does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I smoked mine pretty close to the end. I ran out of drink and I wasn't comfortable getting any more drink. I think if I drink with my cigar a lot, like I think Stacy will tell you that I'm not OCD about very many things, but when I eat pasta or right? I gotta have the right amount of sauce to go with the pasta, or I have to have the right amount of rice to go with my chicken.
Yeah.
I have to have the right amount of drink to go with my cigar. I finish the drink before I finish the cigar. So I stopped smoking the cigar. It, like yours, mine also, Rocky Patel, was consistent all the way through. The hints of the peppery cream as well. That's about all I picked up off of it. Maybe a little hint of woodiness as well. And then as I stopped smoking it, I started to pick up the sweetness of the Cameroon wrapper. Not nearly as sweet as the Cameroon wrapper that's on the Hemingway series, but still a sweet taste that didn't leave this, like, you know, smoky flavor in my mouth. So definitely a good cigar. I mean, I always talk about it. If I had a choice, I'd default to Fuente, but in a pinch, the Rocky Patel did me right.
Awesome. All right.
So, in conclusion, you know, we hope you're a little bit inspired by the words that we shared tonight. Like we said earlier, we're not going to solve any of the world's problems sitting around talking about cigars instantly, but that can be the catalyst for change. So get together with a close friend, talk about the common good, talk about responsibilities and duties while you smoke them if you got them.
All right. Good night.